WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we listen back to an interview with country music star Waylon Jennings. He died Wednesday at the age of 64. He was plagued with health problems related to diabetes. In December, his foot was amputated. Waylon Jennings started his career playing with Buddy Holly and went on to change the sound of country music as a creator of the so-called outlaw movement. Along with Willie Nelson, he originated a sound with less strings, more rock rhythms, and no sequins. Being an outlaw proved a very rewarding experience. Jennings had 16 number one singles and several gold and platinum albums. He also performed with Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, and Willie Nelson as the group The Highwaymen. Before we listen back to a 1996 interview with Waylon Jennings, let's hear the title track of his 1973 album, Honky Tonk Heroes. The song was written by Billy Joe Shaver.
Low down, leaving son, done did everything that needs done. Woe is me, why can't I see? I'd best be leaving well enough alone. Them neon lighting nights couldn't stay out of fights, keep a haunting me in memories. Well, there's one in every crowd for crying out loud. Why was it always turning out to be me? Where does it go? The good Lord only knows. Seems like it was just the other day. I was down at Green Gables, hawking them tables, and generally blowing all my hard-earned pay. Piano rolled blues, danced holes in my shoes. There weren't another way to be. For lovable losers, no-account boozers, and honky-tonk heroes like me.
In your book, you write that country music was looked down on when you were growing up. It was the music of the have-nots. How did that affect your feelings about country music?
Well, I loved it. I didn't care what they thought of it. And it was kind of, I think a lot of people liked it. They just drove down the street, and if they saw somebody they knew, they'd roll up the window where they couldn't hear. But I was never ashamed of liking country music. I'll tell you a good thing that happened to me. I worked in radio at a very young age. I was about 14 when I had my own radio show. And I sang on radio when I was about 12. Can you imagine that yodel? But anyway, they had block programming on this radio station, which would be 15 minutes of jazz, 15 minutes of country and western, 15 minutes of polkas. And I really learned to like all kinds of music, which helped me a lot.
I love your descriptions of those radio shows in your book. You describe going on location to local grocery stores, and you'd sing a few songs yeah. And interview the store's owner. Kind of different from
radio.
Yeah,
named George Sewell's Meat Market. Well, that was up on the hill, and it was Morris Fruit and Vegetable Market right down the street. And we'd do those live broadcasts, and sometimes they'd get a little out of hand.
How so?
Well, we'd slip and cuss or something like that. And there were some, old farmers. You'd go up and one'd say, well, what do you think about this? And you'd say, oh, hell, I don't know anything. In those days, that could get you taken off the air.
Right. Mm-hmm. How did you get to Nashville? Did you have any kind of contract when you got there, or just hoping for the best?
Well, I'll tell you, I was here. I was in Nashville about 8 months before I came here to record. And it's a strange thing, I couldn't get in any door. Nobody knew me, and nobody wanted to know me, I guess. And then 6 months later, when they, quote-unquote, discovered me, everybody wanted me, and I was the talk of the town, when I came to record. And they all loved my music, and they, it was just that type of a thing.
Would you describe what Music Row in Nashville was like when you first settled in there?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a combination of cliques. And that's not bad. There's a bunch of good old boys over here and a bunch of good old boys and girls over there. But they didn't just let you in, you know. And the musicians I brought with me from Phoenix, including my own brother. And I couldn't figure out why they wouldn't talk to them and why they didn't. I could tell they didn't like it because they were there. And so I asked them, what's the deal here? And they said, well, you don't bring your own cliques to Nashville. And you don't bring your musicians down on Music Row. They had the attitude that if you play the road, play the road. And if you're going to be in town, you be in town. And, of course, that went over real well with me. I said, these people have been, they've been hungry with me. And we've been together, and we're in this for the long run. And if they're not welcome, then I'm not.
And then what happened?
Well, there's a few changes made, you know. I kind of convinced them they were wrong, you know, that you don't do that.
I can't remember who was producing the session. It might have been Herb Alpert, where you decided that you just couldn't stand pickup notes. you took a gun and said what?
I took it in the studio, but it was, I think at, on that session, I think that was, I'm not sure, Danny Davis. And that was after Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert would have thrown something at me. But I did go in there. And what had happened is I'd loaned Harlan Howard.
The songwriter.
My gun. It was a bunt line. He took it out in his fishing boat. And Merle Haggard wound up with it somehow, and he brought it back to me. And so I just put on the holster, you know, I still got it and everything, and put it on. And I went in there, and I thought, well, and there were some British journalists were in there in the studio, in the little studio over there at RCA. I walked in, and I said, now, the first guy that I hear use a pickup note, I'm going to shoot his fingers off. And the guy that's sitting there looking at those numbers on that paper, after the third rundown, I'm going to just kill him. Anyway, later on, I met John Lennon. And we were cutting up and everything at one of the Grammy things. And I said, man, you're funny. I didn't know you were funny. I said, I thought you were some kind of mad guy or something like that. And he said, me? He said, listen, people in England think you shoot folks.
No, explain for people who don't know written music what pickup notes are, and then tell us why you're so opposed to them.
Well, you know, it gives it away. You know, it goes, dun, 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 you know, like, and there you know, why not just keep it rolling and rolling and having a good time, and then come in where you're supposed to, and you haven't given everything away. You know, that's what pickup notes do, and it's the easy way, too, because it keeps... You know, you don't have to pay that much attention when you hear a pickup note coming. You know, you got to change keys.
So it's just all becoming formula to you.
It was all formula. It was like cookie cutters. You know, everything you did. And here these guys playing four sessions a day sometime. How creative can you be? You know? And they wouldn't let you use your own band. They didn't want you to use your... I'm not saying one thing bad about the musicians here. They're the greatest musicians in the world because... I mean, they had that number system, and for that music, it was wonderful. I just didn't like, you know, pickup notes, like I said.
In 1973, you collaborated with the songwriter Billy Joe Shaver and put out an album that really established your image as the outlaw in country music. And tell me about how you started working with Billy Joe Shaver and how you think this collaboration changed your image.
Well, I don't know what it did to my image. I think it changed music. I think it changed country music. I got my freedom and got the right to produce my own things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and got Tom Paul Glazier to help me with that. And some of those tracks on there are only three instruments and me singing. which was unheard of in those days. You know, they thought that was a demo. But I was looking for the feeling, not necessarily the full tracks. But I met Billy Joe through Bobby Bear. He had brought him to town, was publishing his things, and had done several of his things. And Chris Christopherson had heard a couple of things and maybe recorded a couple of his songs. And so I called Bobby and I said, "He got any more songs? Because they were great." He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Listen, send me everything he's got over here." So I got to listening to it, and I said, "I'm going to do an album of his songs, all of them." And so I told Billy, I said, "I'm going to do that, but I said, it's going to be a little while before I do it." And Billy got all excited, even threatened to whip me one time if I didn't hurry up and do his album. Because, I mean, he was right out of Waco, Texas, and what I call 1960 Waco. But Billy Joe was a great writer, and he hit it right on the nail, right on the head. And it was, the lyrics and everything were so great. And that record changed the music industry.
We're listening back to a 1996 interview with the late Waylon Jennings. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Waylon Jennings, one of the founders of the country music outlaw movement. He died on Wednesday.
How did the outlaw name come about?
I had an album on RCA, and it was called Ladies Love Outlaws, which was after a song, you know, and they kind of picked it up there. And then when in search of something, they called me everything for a long time. They called me outlaw. They called me rebel. They didn't know quite what pocket to put me in. but that's where it started originally. And then when they decided to put out the album with me and Tom, Paul, Jesse, and Willie, they used it there, and it kind of caught on.
That's the album Wanted the Outlaws, which was the first country album to sell a million, I think.
It was, yeah.
Now, you and Willie Nelson combined country music and, part of the hippie world, long hair and blue jeans.
Wasn't we cute? We were cute.
Did you think of it that way at the time, that you were, bridging two worlds that normally weren't coming together?
Now, what we did, and it wasn't something that intentionally destroyed what Nashville had going, but we realized that we were not going to be accepted on their terms, and because we couldn't be that, and I didn't want to wear no Spanglish suits, although I thought some of the guys looked good in them, when I was growing up, I loved them. But you know what? I didn't want to wear that. And Willie didn't want to wear it either. And we wanted to play our own music. We didn't want, sock rhythms. And we had guys that played our music the way we wanted it. But we saw that we were not going to fit. And that was it. Willie moved to Texas, but I stayed in Nashville. But I realized, we were outsiders. And then all of a sudden, we sold a lot of records. And they just went nuts. And we were their fair-haired children, but it was too late. We kind of ignored all of that. And they were telling us how wonderful. And they were with us all the way and knew it all along. It was going to happen. And but we paid. We just did what we wanted to because, you know what? When they were in control of us and of our lives, they did what they wanted to. It wasn't get even time or anything like that. We just, I guess we looked like hippies. Well, I know we did. Cowboy hippies anyway. And then all of a sudden, we were drawing 70,000 or 200,000 young people, along with the others, and it worked. That was it.
So suddenly, I guess everybody wanted to be an outlaw, huh?
I guess. Yeah, I guess so.
Why don't I play one of the recordings featured on the Wanted the Outlaws album that you did with Willie Nelson, Jesse Coulter. This is something you co-wrote with Willie Nelson, and you both sing on it. and it's A Good-Hearted Woman, which you also recorded on your own. Tell me about this particular track.
That song, Willie and I wrote that while we were playing poker one time in a hotel with Billy Gray and Paul English.
Wait, you were playing poker with Billy Graham?
Billy Gray.
Oh. I thought that sounded improbable.
Billy Graham cheats. We don't let him play no more. But anyway, and so I was recording the next day, and I said, Willie, I like two lines in this song. You help me get them, and I'll give you half this song. So we did, but we wrote it while we was playing poker. Now, we lost our rears in that poker game, but we got a pretty good song.
Why don't we hear A Good-Hearted Woman? This is Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson.
He likes the bright lights and nightlife and good time frame. And when the party's all over, she'll welcome him back home again. Lord knows she don't understand him, but she does the best that she can. This a good-hearted woman loving a good-time man. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. She loves me in spite of my wicked ways that she don't understand. This world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman loving a good-timing man.
My guest, Waylon Jennings, with Willie Nelson, one of the tracks featured on their album, Wanted, The Outlaws. There was a rather long period in your life where you went through a lot of coke and pills and women and had guns and... I think it was, well, I can't remember exactly when it was that you gave up drugs, and you say it took 8 years after that before you wrote a song or before you were able to be on stage and feel like you weren't boring people sick. 8 years to figure out who you were again. What did it take to figure out who you were again after giving up drugs? I mean, if you could describe what the confusion or disorientation was like when you gave up drugs and you were straight.
You know, as corny as it sounds, it's like it's another person. And he's very real. And everything you do when you're on cocaine, you can blame it on him. You know, it's like you're still sitting over here and you're a good guy. And when you quit, you actually mourn for that person because that person dies. You're alone again. When you go into a room, you don't know how you're supposed to act, or what people or who people think you are. You know, they cause a little of it too, because they wonder. It's like one of the guys that worked with me when I quit drugs. They said he was paranoid anyway, but he said he asked the Jerry Bridges that plays bass with me at that time. Says, "Have you seen Waylon since he's been off drugs?" And he said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, what do you think? You think he'll like me still?" He says, "I don't know. I'll ask him." But it's kind of like that. They don't know. And then you have these people. A lot of people have written things like, "I liked him better when he was on drugs." That don't help a lot. But I didn't write for a long time. And because with drugs, the big addiction is you don't think you can do anything without them. And you have people telling you that you're much better when you're on drugs. But it took, like I say, about 8 years, and I started writing again. I got to some of the writers here in town, Troy Seals and Roger Murrow. And I got to co-writing, because most of my writing had been done by myself. And I got to writing songs and with them, and that helped that. And then my wife, Jessie, helped me through a lot of the rest of it. Every once in a while, I'd say, "Boy, I wish I had some cocaine." And she knew exactly what I was doing. Just when you think of it, say it. Last 7 seconds.
So when was it that you actually gave up drugs?
84. It was March the 30th. I tried to do all I had with me, and I couldn't. And so I on the 29th, I quit when I threw the bottle away. And on the 30th, from that day on, I never did any drugs at all.
You say when you gave up drugs, you probably doubled or tripled the number of cigarettes that you were smoking.
Yeah.
Which isn't a very good thing for a smoker in particular, for a singer in particular. How did it affect your voice to be smoking so much? And do you still smoke?
No, I quit smoking in 88. I was up to 6 or 7 packs a day sometimes.
Wow. That's a lot.
I just smoked. Well,
you
when I was
probably have
drugs,
to smoke through the night to do that much.
No, not really.
No?
Just light one off the other. But when I was on drugs, I smoked constantly, and I stayed up for 5 and 6 days and nights at a time. So that was pretty easy to smoke that much. But I have, stayed up all those hours and everything, smoked all those cigarettes, and my voice has stuck with me somehow. It got to getting pretty bad at the end there, but it stuck with me pretty good.
Waylon Jennings recorded in 1996. He died Wednesday at the age of 64. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.